I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, more national attention around the travesty unfolding in Washington's women's prison. Plus, all of a sudden, the media wants to police the phrase election interference. And California advances a plan to help illegal immigrants buy a house, except there's one big problem with it. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Washington State is embarrassing itself on the national stage. I don't know how long it will take to realize that some of the things we're doing here, some of the experiments we're doing here in the name of extreme gender ideology in particular, history is not going to look back on it kindly. I don't know if it's going to take people dying. I don't know if it's going to take the state being sued into oblivion, but whatever it takes, it has to happen. And I think having some national exposure to what's happening here could be helpful. If people will wake up and see, you know, even progressives, that some of these things are doing the opposite of what they claim to care about. So we have talked about the issue of what's happening in Washington State's prison for women. We have talked about the fact that a male offender, regardless of what they did, what their crime was, can decide to identify as a woman, can, with their anatomy intact, just say, I'm a woman now and I want to be housed with other women in the women's prison. And that has happened. And not only does it happen, the state of Washington has made it very clear to the media and to the public at large that you're not allowed to know anything about it. You're not allowed to request documents through the Public Records Act that would, in their assertion, put these transgender inmates at risk. But in our assertion, and anyone in the media or the public who wants to know what's happening to these women behind bars would expose some serious wrongdoing. I mean, we can't get our hands on anything. I remember Nicole and Dory on their show when they tried to do public records requests and report on what was happening in these women's prisons. They were sent cease and desist letters. And so there is a lockdown on any questions, information, public records, whatever it is, about what's happening when a man, oftentimes a violent man, is taken out of the men's prison and incarcerated with women because he decides to identify as a woman. There is a reporter nationally with the National Review who's been doing stories on what's happening in Washington State on this for a long time and just released a new report. Her name is Caroline Downey, and it is disgusting. It is absolutely disgusting. Anyone who claims to care about women but doesn't speak out about this doesn't actually care about women. Anyone who claims to care about inmates, I mean, there's a huge swath of progressives who say that, you know, they who don't even want people incarcerated, but, you know, want to make sure that they're pushing for the rights of inmates. Any of them who claim to care about inmates and the well-being of inmates that doesn't speak out about this is an absolute disingenuous liar. So let me read a few passages, and I'll just warn you again, as I had to do a lot last week talking about the sex offender issue. This does detail abuse and trauma, etc. So again, if that's something that you just do not want to be exposed to on the show today, I suggest maybe tuning out for the first 10 minutes or so of the show. With that, the headline from the National Review: male child molester housed in women's prison under investigation for sexually harassing female cellmate. Caroline Downey writes, a male child molester currently being housed in the Washington Correction Center for Women has repeatedly sexually harassed a female inmate who is herself a victim of child rape. That's according to the victim, Mozzie Clark Sanchez, who spoke to the National Review. Clark Sanchez says she woke up once to find that her shirt had been pulled over her breasts. She said she believes that the male inmate, Christopher Williams, touched her in her sleep. To help with night terrors from her traumatic childhood, Clark Sanchez took medication that put her in a deep sleep. This victim, again, a woman, Mozzie Clark Sanchez, she was raped by her uncle as a child. her mom used to sell her to pay for her drugs. She was molested by her uncle starting at the age of 5 years old, told the National Review he would cut her down there so he could rape her. So this is a woman who has gone through an awful lot of trauma in her life, is now incarcerated for other crimes. But she is now saying and telling the National Review that a man, Christopher Williams, who is being housed with her, she believes that he was touching her breasts at night, wakes up with her shirt pulled over her breasts. She had to deal with her past trauma. She was taking medication that would put her in a deep sleep. And not only that, she tells the National Review that Williams brought a strap-on dildo into the room and asked her to use it on him, and that he routinely made predatory remarks toward her, such as, quote, "All these girls want this. I don't know why you don't." And you might be wondering, well, where would this inmate get a strap-on dildo? And we don't know the details of, you know, this particular inmate's transition, what they may have gotten done or not done. But we do know, as we've covered in previous stories, that male inmates who decide to do a transition are given tools to, how do I even put this? We've talked about on the show before, to basically stretch out what was created for them. So certainly there are transgender inmates who have things resembling dildos that are allowed in the women's prison. Now, whether Christopher has one of these because he underwent some sort of surgery, or whether it's from a different trans inmate, we don't know. But again, this is what this female inmate is telling the National Review. So who is this Christopher Williams? Who is this biological man that in Washington state we are so woke that we will put this biological man behind lock and key with women? What did this biological man do to get in prison in the first place? Well, according to the National Review, Williams is currently serving a 342-month sentence at Purdy, the women's facility, for a first-degree assault he committed in 2012 in a domestic violence case. So in June of 2012, he assaulted his girlfriend. He hit her in the head with a pipe. He was transferred to the women's prison after the conviction. So he committed a domestic violence assault, hit his girlfriend in the head with a pipe, gets convicted, sent to men's prison. Then he says, I'm a girl. And now this guy with a history of attacking women gets to be behind lock and key with women. Before moving to Purdy, Williams was at a men's correction center where, in September of 2012, he allegedly assaulted a male prison officer to the point that the officer was rendered unconscious. Williams admitted to the confrontation in which he used his fists and elbows to strike the officer multiple times, leaving blood all over him and a gash in his head, and Williams only stopped when he heard the officer, quote, screaming like a little baby. That's Christopher Williams, what he said about the officer. Oh, I stopped because he was screaming like a little baby. So this is a man who is strong enough to beat a prison guard bloody to the point of unconsciousness, who has a history of violence against women, who decides one day to identify as a woman and is thrown in a cell with a woman who has a history of abuse, who believes that he has been touching her breasts at night while she's in a deep sleep because of medication, asking her to use a dildo on him. If you are an advocate for women, how could you be okay with that? If you're an advocate for inmates, how could you be okay with that? And we've heard so many stories like this. There was a James O'Keefe expose, and all the left wanted to disregard it because, oh, it's James O'Keefe and he's right wing. No, he had women inmates from prison doing video visits, video calls, recorded them where they were telling him about what they are enduring, about their fear of being incarcerated with biological men, detailing all the concerns they had about how they couldn't even sleep at night. They were so concerned. And it's like, well, no, we don't believe them. They're just over-exaggerating. They're just being dramatic. And then at the same time, the only glimpses that we get of this are female inmates who have the courage to reach out to the media and try to tell their stories. Because again, the Washington State Department of Corrections, the state of Washington, they absolutely refuse to provide any public records on what's happening with transgender inmates or biological men in the women's prison, because it's, you know, protected health data or whatever it is. Bull. So we don't get to know, and not to mention that this is an issue that opens up the state of Washington to immense legal jeopardy. If you've got women who are impregnated behind bars, if you've got women who are raped behind bars by a biological man, if you've got women who are beaten or assaulted behind bars by a biological man who is allowed to be in their prison, who's going to pay the price for that besides the female inmate who's either pregnant, dead, or traumatized? Well, the taxpayers of the state of Washington are going to pay the price for that when that female inmate rightfully sues. So again, I don't know, you know, for the I don't even want to call it the left, because I really think if you were to ask every single Washingtonian in confidence whether they think that this is appropriate, I genuinely believe 90% of them would say no. Now, they might not say that publicly, because of course, oh my gosh, you can't say anything about transgender people. Even a domestic abuser who beat a prison guard to unconsciousness and then got to be housed with women. Yeah, you can't say anything about that because they're transgender. And then I would be, you know, called a bigot or a transphobe or whatever it is. But I guarantee 90%, I think, of Washingtonians, if asked in private in confidence, would say, this is absurd. How could we be doing that to women? And the same is true for state lawmakers. I mean, the legislature in Olympia has gone very far to the left. But if we could get every single one of them on the record where they had to own their position on it, right? I really don't think it would be a majority of lawmakers who would support something like this. So I don't know if the tide is turning on it. I applaud inmates like this woman who are willing to speak out on a national platform in the National Review and say, here's what's happening to me. Now, as the National Review said, this man, Christopher Williams, this inmate, is under investigation for sexually harassing the female cellmate. Although, based on her depiction, it sounds like much more than sexual harassment. It sounds like potential sexual assault. But do you think that we're going to be able to get our hands on the result of that investigation? Absolutely not. We'll try. We'll show you what happens when we make public records requests about transgender inmates in the women's prison. We'll do that today. We'll do that this week. And we'll show you it'll be a swift, prompt rejection letter to say, nope, you can't get your hands on that, because we're not allowed to know the horrors that are happening to these women who are being locked up with monsters. And look, these women committed crimes too. I get that. You know, in Washington state, we don't put people in prison, generally speaking, for nonviolent offenses. You have to do something very serious to actually be incarcerated in the state of Washington. So yeah, these women are in prison. I'm sure some of them have hurt other people. But again, if you don't care about their health and well-being while they're behind bars, you still ought to care about the legal jeopardy it puts the state of Washington and the taxpayer in. But I would also say that no woman, regardless of the crime they've committed to land them in incarceration, no woman should be locked in a cell for up to 23 hours a day with a biological male who has a history of beating women and beating other men unconscious. No woman deserves that. And you call your progressives. Progressives, my ass. What's progress about that? It's progressive to, like, force women to live with male predators. It's insane. And I don't know, it has to take some progressives to wake up and say, we can't continue to do this to women. This isn't what we stand for. This isn't what we signed up for. This isn't what we expected. So who's it going to be? Who is the progressive lawmaker that is going to finally put their foot down and say, hey, we can't do this? Tara Simmons? Would Tara Simmons be willing to stand up for these women? Tara Simmons, who was once herself incarcerated, who now is a state lawmaker. Surely she believes that, I would venture to guess, some women she used to be incarcerated with who have been serving time for a while. They deserve to be safe. I bet she would agree, right, that they deserve to be safe. So we'll also do that. We'll do a public disclosure request this week. We'll show you how promptly the state of Washington will deny it. And then we'll reach out to Representative Tara Simmons and ask her whether these women who are incarcerated, just as she once was, deserve to feel safe and secure while they're behind bars. I wanted to get to another national story that has Washington ties. And I was going to talk about this on the show yesterday. I figured we'd save it for today. It's just fascinating to me. So this came, somebody sent it to me and said, hey, you were mentioned in The New Yorker. And I was like, great. I'm sure it was glowing. It's interesting. So the premise of the story that I'm going to set up, I actually don't mind. I think it's a interesting story. I talked often about the overuse of words and phrases that dilute their meaning. For instance, racist. The word racist has been absolutely overused to the point where it no longer means anything. You have a segment of the left that will call absolutely everything and everyone racist. I mean, that used to be like one of the worst things you could call someone. And so you use that word very sparingly, right? Because racist, labeling someone a racist is very significant. But now they say racist, and it's like in one ear, out the other. So it's an abuse and an overuse of that word. So what The New Yorker dug into is whether the phrase election interference is being used into oblivion, where the same effect. Cry wolf doesn't mean anything anymore. The headline from The New Yorker, the election interference merry-go-round. And I want to read the first two paragraphs of it for you because the example they use, the premise of this story, is actually what happened here in Washington State with Bob Ferguson and the two other Bobs that, you know, got on the ballot at the last minute, then got off the ballot, and everything that ensued after this. And I actually think it's a really interesting narrative, and this is where they mention me, but let me read these first two paragraphs. It says, in October 2020, Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General of Washington State, launched an initiative to combat election interference. A press release noted Donald Trump's repeated claims that the coming election would be rigged against him, leading many of Ferguson's constituents to fear that the result was being delegitimized in advance. In response, Ferguson pledged to defend, quote, the long-standing American tradition of a peaceful transition of power. This year, Ferguson ran for governor of Washington as a Democrat. So too did Bob Ferguson and Bob Ferguson. The latter Fergusons, a retired state employee and a military veteran, respectively, were recruited as candidates by Glenn Morgan, a conservative activist. Allies of the original Ferguson accused Morgan of deliberately trying to confuse voters. In a tweet, Ferguson called the gambit, quote, election interference, and pointed out that the other Fergusons could be prosecuted under state law if they didn't withdraw. Morgan, for his part, threatened legal action against Ferguson and anyone in his orbit who tried to, quote, intimidate me or the candidates I am helping run for a political office, an act that would be, he suggested, itself election interference. In the end, the other Fergusons did pull out, but not before Ferguson had tried and failed to have Washington's Secretary of State move his name above theirs on the ballot. In an op-ed, Brandy Cruz, a former TV journalist in Seattle, charged that this was election interference and urged voters to remember it, quote, the next time Ferguson talks about the threat of Trumpism to democracy. So it's actually an interesting tale that they're spinning in this article. And again, I think the premise of it is interesting. Or is the word election interference being overused? And they look at just this one example in Washington State centered around Bob Ferguson, where he accuses Trump of election interference. He accuses the other Bobs of election interference. In return, Glenn Morgan accuses Bob Ferguson of election interference. I accuse Bob Ferguson of election interference for wanting the Secretary of State to change the order on the ballot. So the whole premise is fine. I'm fine with everything about it, where they're like, okay, the word election interference, what's the issue here? Although I cannot help but notice that the media suddenly wants to police this phrase election interference when the right starts to use it. The left has thrown around election interference, threat to our democracy, I mean, nonstop since 2016. Nonstop. And I can't recall, might have missed one, but I can't recall any big national expose saying, oh, the phrase election interference is being overused by the left. We should really stop and consider what is actually election interference and isn't. No, they're just upset that now the right is saying, well, if you're going to accuse us of election interference, we're going to start to point out things that Democrats are doing that are also election interference. I mean, RFK Jr. just did it, right? this past week when he endorsed Donald Trump, and he pointed out the lawfare that Democrats are using that amounts to election interference in our state, for instance, trying to keep Trump and RFK Jr. off the ballot. I released a couple weeks ago a long list of things Democrats have done that maybe I didn't call election interference per se, but attacks on our democratic process, which is essentially the same thing. So now that Republicans are starting to speak up and speak out about acts of election interference, now the New Yorker's like, well, just put a pause on it. Like, cool your jets. We need to really decide whether this whole phrase is just overused. So it says, and again, it focuses on kind of like, and look, I don't think the guy, John Alsop, who did the article, I don't think it was a particularly bad article. But again, the whole premise of it is ridiculous to me in the context of why now and not then? Why like police this phrase now, but not have been policing it for the last, I don't know, 6 years, right? But he goes on to say, as with other Trump-era catchphrases, for instance, fake news, the meaning of election interference has in many respects grown more elusive as various political actors, not least Trump himself, have co-opted, warped, and weaponized it. There it is. I guess the right is weaponizing it. And then he goes on to, he asks a UCLA law professor, because he admits that he can't come up with a viable phrase for election interference because he doesn't want it to be too narrow. He doesn't want it to be too broad. So he quotes, or he talks to this UCLA professor. He says, the professor told me he doesn't mean to diminish the wide range of factors that might weigh on an election outcome, from the American campaign finance system to foreign powers stealing documents, but he nonetheless defines election interference relatively narrowly as the use of illegal means to manipulate vote totals or change results after the fact, and argues that including broader efforts to sway public opinion in the definition risks cheapening it. He said, this kind of language policing matters to me. It's about reserving a very serious term for a very serious set of behaviors. So this is the last sentence of this whole article. This article is very, very long. But if you want to read it, I highly suggest you do. So the author of the article, at the very end, brings it back to the Bob Ferguson thing. And he says, Bob Ferguson, perhaps, had it right the first time. So of course, it's like, all the times we accused Bob of election interference, we weren't right, but he brings it home and says, but Bob Ferguson was. But what Bob Ferguson calls election interference is actually election interference. But here's the thing. You've never heard me, I don't think, I tend to have a okay memory, deny that like some of the things Trump did could serve to interfere in the election. And I think that's kind of the difference here is I'm not downplaying, for instance, the three Bobs thing, three Bobs. Like I said, that I thought that that was immature. It looked like Republicans had to cheat to win, and it was completely inappropriate. Now, I had a good laugh at it, but I did say they need to withdraw their names, and I was happy that they withdrew their names. So I didn't defend that kind of behavior. And so it's a matter of kind of moral consistency, right? And election interference, in my mind, I don't think you have to put a definition on it. I think you know it when you see it. And to me, it's really anything that would unfairly or illegally change the results of an election. Is that such a hard definition? Anything that would unfairly or illegally change the results of an election. So for instance, Bob Ferguson wanting his name moved up on the ballot, that could both unfairly and illegally have changed the results of the election. So that's fair. Storming the U.S. Capitol while they were trying to certify the election, that could unfairly and illegally change the results of the election. So yeah, I think that's election interference. Washington State Democrats pushing out a snitch line to send out their minions to harass lawful signature gatherers, that could both unfairly and illegally change the results of whether the initiatives were on the ballot and therefore change the results of the election. So to me, what I don't like is that Democrats think they have some sort of like trademark of the phrase election interference, and they can accuse Trump of it every single day of the week and say Republicans are a threat to the democracy. But the second Republicans start saying, wait, you're doing some things that look an awful lot like election interference and threatening our democracy. And now the New Yorker's writing like a 7,000 page word about maybe we should police the phrase election interference because now the right's using it. It's a little bit ridiculous. But anyway, thanks for the shout out, the New Yorker. Oop, I love how they call me a former TV journalist, which is fine, I guess. I mean, I have a podcast,
you know. We would
have
liked a little shout out to the podcast.
Yeah, a little shout out for our podcast. That's totally
you are currently something.
I am something. Thank you. Thanks, Nicole. Thank you. Oh, snort. Has been a while for a snort. Anyway. Okay. We got a lot to get to on the show today. It's going to be one of those days. What's with me and the first block of the show always going a half hour? It's really a good thing we don't have commercial breaks in the traditional sense because I'd miss them every time.
But that's how it works. Top story. Deserves a lot.
Deserves a lot of time. Well, we got some good stuff coming up next, including a promise Dow Constantine made in 2020, crashing and burning, just like the construction trailers at the youth jail that were lit on fire in 2020. But first, I have successfully kept off my weight loss on Eastside Weight Loss Clinic for about 2 years now. So November 1st will mark 2 years since I embarked on my Eastside Weight Loss journey. And has it been easy the whole way? Of course not. Of course it hasn't been easy. I've struggled with weight my entire life, but this is the longest I've ever kept weight loss off. Like, I've been on the roller coaster, the ups and downs and stuff. But for me, the nice thing about the Eastside Weight Loss program is you can always go back to it. You can always go back to it. You do 60 days of really hard work and commitment. I lost about 30 pounds in the first 60 days. And then you make some lifestyle changes to be able to maintain your weight loss. And there are times, of course, like this summer, man, we had 2 weeks there where I felt like I had an event every single night. I was having drinks, enjoying good food, company and all that. And at the end of that, I was like, I think I put on a couple pounds. It's like, okay, I got the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program in my back pocket. And that's what gives you the confidence to really feel like, okay, I'm going to lose the weight quickly, and then I'm going to be able to keep it off for life. So do what I did, what so many others have done. Embark on your own Eastside Weight Loss Clinic journey today. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I texted Dr. Coogan the other day. I said, I'm adding on weight, but it's muscle mass. I've been like trying to look at those guns.
Bulk up.
Can't really, no, bulk up. Still elegant. But you know, I was like, I got to, because before, I was like 2018, I had a trainer. I was going like 3 days a week. And remember how jacked I was? My butt was like, it was so high. Mm-hmm. It was like, it probably lifted like a foot off the ground. Wow. When I went with my trainer. We were doing booty every day. And I kind of got away from going to the gym, and now I'm like, I'm back. So I'm doing like three a week. I was like, I'm adding weight. I told him I'm gaining weight, but it's muscle weight. And he said, good for you. That's the best kind of weight to gain.
There you go.
Anyway.
You got approval.
I did. I digress. Okay. A couple stories here. So in 2020, in the middle of the summer of love, while everyone was rioting over issues of race and social justice following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, King County Executive Dow Constantine, who was still at the time just thinking and waiting in the wings to run for governor, plans that were ultimately derailed, he was making all sorts of grand promises to the far left, including this one that he tweeted out on July 21st, 2020. He said, "Today, I commit King County to converting the remaining youth detention unit at the children's facility to other uses as quickly as possible and no later than 2025. So he was saying that he was basically going to end juvenile detention by 2025. And he made this bold promise in the middle of the summer of love. And he also reiterated that promise in his State of the County address that same year.
I will propose capital funding to further reduce the space available for detention and convert it to therapeutic and community use. And I will propose additional investments to help create safe and community-based solutions for the increasingly difficult youth cases that remain, and seek to fully convert the remaining youth detention capacity to other uses as quickly as possible and no later than 2025.
No later than 2025. Well, let's see. It's, I'm going to just carry the two, add three, October, November. That's 3 months away. So, like, he's got to be close, right? Like, this youth detention facility should be closing any day, right? Yeah, no. Yesterday, King County rejected Constantine's measure to close the juvenile detention center. And this is according to the Center Square. Members of the Metropolitan King County Council got an earful from the public Tuesday ahead of a vote on a proposal to reject a bid to close the Patricia H. Clark Children and Family Justice Center and instead shift responsibilities for juvenile detention to private organizations. And this to me is, first of all, I'm glad they voted that way. because we've been, and we've talked about, you know, the juvenile crime crisis. Now, Dow Constantine made some empty promise in 2020 based on feelings and not based on reality. Didn't do anything as a leader to actually reduce the number of juveniles who are committing crimes so serious that they have to be incarcerated or held in juvenile detention. So here we are, 4 years after that promise, with a worse juvenile crime crisis than we have ever had before. And so I'm glad the King County Council, just in the name of, like, living up to this empty promise Dow made, didn't say, yeah, we've got to close the thing, because we would have been in a big, big crisis if that happened. So they decided, no, we've got to keep it open for now. And they did that despite the fact, just to give them credit, despite the fact that a bunch of unhinged lefties showed up at the council meeting to testify.
Putting children in cages is abuse, no matter what way you phrase it or word it.
About half of these detained youth are Black. When the public declared Black Lives Matter in 2020, Constantine said, redemption begins by shifting public dollars away from systems that are rooted in oppression and into those that maintain public health and safety and help people on the path to success.
It is heartbreaking to see a child deteriorate while they are being locked up rather than receiving the proper care.
Juvenile detention centers exacerbate mental health issues, disrupt education, increase the likelihood of future criminal behavior, making the people who feel unsafe even more unsafe.
And what I find to be a capricious and despicable argument that because of a very small handful of very violent offenders that we really are struggling to find a better solution to, we need to maintain something for decades, for tens and dozens and dozens of predominantly disproportionately Black and brown children.
Please, let's just keep doing the work on trying to find alternatives for the Patricia Clark Center.
That's fine. I am fully in support of continuing to do work to find alternatives. And also, hopefully, continuing to do work to figure out why do we have a disproportionate number of Black and brown kids who are committing crimes that land them in juvenile detention. You know, these people want you to believe, and I would never been able to say this on TV, so God bless you guys for letting me work directly for you. You know, whenever they say disproportionate, right, they're acting like this is like the racist system, like police are disproportionately arresting young Black men. They see young white men committing crimes, and they're like, nothing to see here, folks. No, I'm sorry, but maybe there is a disproportionate number of Black and brown juveniles who are in juvenile detention because there's a disproportionate number of Black and brown juveniles who are committing crimes. Do you ever stop to maybe think about that? And maybe we ought to really think about the root causes of that behavior. I mean, look at the gang activity in South Seattle. It's not white kids picking up guns and shooting each other on the streets. It's not. Now, I'm not saying white kids have never committed crimes with guns, of course, but when you look at that, Jay Inslee, for instance, and Bob Ferguson, they'll spend weeks talking about a white kid who brought a gun to school. Horrible, awful, right? We should focus on that. But then they'll spend 20 years ignoring Black and brown youth who are shooting and killing each other on the streets. Because, like, one, well, we can't talk about that because of their skin pigmentation. So let's focus on these rare, rare instances. Let's also focus our gun control laws on these rare, rare instances to keep these weapons of war away from, like, the rare instance of a white kid picking up a gun and bringing it to school or wherever it is. And the shootings happening every single day out on the streets. Can't do, let's not say anything about that. So that's part of it too. Oh, and then when we do, you know, arrest a Black or brown youth, like, let's make sure we just send them home to mom and dad and right back to the neighborhood where they're committing crimes without any bail. Like, and we wonder why we're in this situation that we're in right now. That first guy, is that not? If I had to, like, is this mean? If I had to draw, like, just having never watched the meeting, a cartoon of who I thought showed up to testify in, like, a little speech bubble of what I thought they said, it would be that first. Can you play that first guy again?
Sure.
Just the guy with the little red highlights. I don't know if you could call
it. Putting children in cages is abuse, no matter what way you phrase it or word it.
Yeah, putting children in cages is abuse. What did the kids do to get in the cages, okay? What did they do? Did they abuse someone? Did they hurt someone? Did they shoot someone? We don't put juveniles in cages unless they did something very, 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 very serious, especially in King County. We know that. So something tells me that maybe they committed some sort of abusive act to be able to get in the cage in the first place. But hey, why don't you go to court at their first appearance and tell the judge that you are more than happy to be responsible for them, to post their bail, and to make sure that they abide by all the conditions of their release, and you can have them in your house outside of a cage. Redheaded man, are you want to do that? Just crazy. Just these people drive me nuts. It's like, it's abuse.
If you would like to be taken seriously, then take yourself seriously.
100%. Because the second I see the look, and I think sometimes, like, we have this woman we just love. I'm not trying to be mean about people who color their hair, right? Because I have Lynette. I love Lynette, and she's got purple hair, and Lynette's rocking it, and she's doing her thing. But, like, it's the Seattle activists who are still, like, of working age, trying to find a job or a career, and they're spending the middle of their day saying putting violent juveniles in cages is abuse, and they've got their little red hair and pink hair. It's just like, it's too much for me. It's too much for me. All right, there were also some sane citizens who showed up to offer their testimony as well.
But I am here speaking on behalf of my 17-year-old daughter who was brutally assaulted at school during passing. Her attackers were minorities, and she was specifically told that her white skin would not protect her, and her white skin got what it deserved. The young lady who attacked my daughter has been in and out of the system. Diversion has not helped her. She was on probation when she attacked my daughter. My daughter has every right, just like every other child in this room, to be able to attend school and be safe.
Please keep the Clark Children and Family Justice Center open. Even the Seattle Times says, please keep it open. We need it. We need a secure facility to hold violent youth offenders, especially the repeat offenders. It is the job of government to keep the public safe. It is the job of government to keep us safe.
It's honestly, it's really one of the only, I think, core responsibilities of government is to ensure to the best of their ability public safety, and that people are following the rules of a civil society, right? And so, you know, having laws on the books, enforcing those laws. And also, this whole debate is just stupid because it comes at a time where our juvenile prisons, the two in the state that house juveniles, aren't taking any new offenders because they are completely over capacity. So if you had shut down like a juvie facility and it's like you've got juvie prisons that aren't even taking new people, that's how bad the problem is. That's how bad the crisis is. So if you want to fix it, again, continue to work on alternatives. Can you have alternatives to traditional incarceration or cells or cages or whatever it is that can guarantee that the public is kept safe? Because you have to, right? I mean, you have to guarantee that the public can, no matter what kind of rehabilitation you're doing while someone is in there, you have to guarantee that it can keep the public safe. So at some point, that is going to be, it's going to have to look like a secure facility. Might not be a traditional prison cell or a quote-unquote cage, but it has to be secure. We also know it has to be secure because of the people working with the juveniles. Look at what's happening at Greenhill School, the juvie facility down in Centralia, where they have assault after assault after assault on prison staff. And that is a secure facility. So, you know, all these people, they're living in this completely law land. And shame on Dow Constantine. At the end of the day, shame on Dow Constantine. For in 2020, checking the political winds, saying, oh, which way are they blowing? And then proudly exclaiming, we're going to end youth detention. And we're going to do it by 2025 because he wanted to raise his political star so he could run for governor. And then, of course, Bob Ferguson bullied him out of even running behind the scenes. We know 100% that that happened. So maybe he made this promise for nothing. But he did that. And now 5 years later, he's embarrassed because they can't make good on that promise. And that's what happens when you push policies and make pledges based on feelings and based on political ambition and not actually based on reality. So Dow Constantine, congratulations on that. All right, moving right along. If your Labor Day plans include taking a ferry to the islands, I highly suggest making other Labor Day plans. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Our ferry system is a disaster. An absolute disaster. I genuinely mean that, though. If you have Labor Day plans to go to the islands, just find something else to do. From experience, having to go to the islands for a wedding and waiting 6 hours for a ferry, it's so unpredictable. Unless you have all the time in the world, and you're not on a schedule and you can afford to sit and wait for 6 hours or whatever it is for a ferry, Fine, if that like is something that you're totally okay with doing. But man, if you want to enjoy your Labor Day weekend, do not spend it out on the islands where you have to rely on a ferry. And what's been happening for the last roughly 48 hours is a really good example why. So I got to take you through this tangled web. Nicole and I, before the show, I was sitting here and I was so frustrated. I was like trying to understand this web of, it's like this domino of failure, right? Where it's like one boat's out for this reason, so then these boats get moved and those boats are out, and then there's a staffing shortage. And so you look at like when there's one, you know, failure in the system, how much it can spread to other areas of the system. And that's really the issue, is our Washington State ferry system is teetering on the brink of disaster. Where you, if you've got one cancellation or one crew shortage, it impacts the entire system and it can just crumble and ruin your plans or ruin people's ability to commute to and from work or to get to doctor's appointments, see family, et cetera, et cetera. So this is from the Seattle Times. The headline, Kingston Seattle Fast Ferry Service canceled until further notice. So there is a fast ferry, which is a passenger only ferry that goes from Kingston to Seattle. Well, it's canceled until further notice. It says Kitsap Transit has canceled all sailings on its passenger-only ferry service between Kingston and downtown Seattle, citing a mechanical failure with one of its vessels. The disrupted sailings stem from the failure of a part of the propulsion system in the Enitai and Commander ferries, which sailed the Kingston and Southworth routes until the transit agency was made aware of the malfunctioning part this summer. The vendor that manufactures the $15,000 part told Kitsap Transit it could take up to 20 weeks to deliver a replacement, manufactured in Finland. Once it arrives, the ferry must be dry docked while the part is installed, and the Coast Guard must confirm the boat is working and meets federal regulations before it can sail. So that's a disaster. And that's obviously an extension kind of the Washington State ferry system, where you have some counties that run, like King County has a fast ferry. And so in this case, it's Kitsap Transit that has this fast ferry. So what's the workaround here, right, for people who relied on this fast ferry to get from Kingston to Seattle? So they said that you could then take a bus from Kingston to Bainbridge Island, and then you could take the Bainbridge Island ferry over to downtown Seattle. Now, that already sounds annoying and inconvenient, but then there's another issue, because of course, Washington State Ferries is a disaster, and so while people who were having to deal with a canceled fast ferry were then gonna take the bus over to Bainbridge to take the Washington State ferry, well, those ferries were being canceled as well. It says WSF canceled, I hate to laugh, because it's not funny, it's annoying. Having been there, it's really annoying. WSF canceled numerous sailings Tuesday morning because of a crew shortage. By 2 p.m., the Bainbridge-Seattle route was back to two boats and running largely on schedule by 2 p.m. Wow, how convenient. Crew shortages Tuesday also led to canceled sailings on the Southworth Fauntleroy Vashon Triangle route and the Inter-Island route connecting Anacortes to Lopez, Shaw, Orcas, and San Juan Islands. To compound the problem, right after a power issue suspended all sailings out of Southworth for about an hour on Tuesday, the terminal's ramp became inoperable, canceling all sailings for both WSF and Kitsap Transit. No timeline was given for when sailings out of Southworth would begin again. So you can see why Nicole and I, for the last like 10 minutes before the show, I was like, I don't get it. I'm trying to piece together the whole chain of events. But suffice it to say, it's a disaster. And again, that's when you know that things are being just, it's a house of cards, right? Because you can't afford to have one crew member call in sick or show up late. You can't afford to have one boat out of service. You can't, as a county agency, rely on the state agency to be able to pick up the slack if you have a boat out or a fast ferry out, because they're going to have ferries out too. So it's a mess. And I think one of the things that shocks me are like, is this, first of all, from Governor Inslee, this insistence on moving forward with his electrification plans with the ferries, because we know that's going to take longer. They're not even sure if it's going to fit the needs that we have, but he is so set on it that he's unwilling to back away from it, completely unwilling to back away from it. But that's just one issue, right? Going to keep bringing it up. We fired a lot of ferry workers over the vaccine. And so when you have crew shortages and you let a bunch of hardworking, lifelong public servants go over a vaccine mandate that we came to realize really wasn't going to serve the purpose that you thought it was going to serve. So it's a variety of things, from the electrification efforts to the staffing issues, and to just plain old government incompetence, right? To plan ahead, to make sure things are well maintained, etc. I would also note, because this is just frustrating. So in fairness, all of the candidates for governor, the main candidates pre-primary, were not in favor. They said they were not in favor of Governor Inslee's electrification plan and his sort of plan in general for the ferry system moving forward, because they wanted people to to know that, hey, we see that the ferry system is a disaster and it can't continue down the path that it's on. It just kind of bothers me, I guess, that like news agencies are giving Bob Ferguson like all the credit for that, because it's sort of like Dave Reichert came out way before them and said, this is a big issue. Here's what we have to do. And then it was like Bob Ferguson just stole his plan and then got a bunch of credit for it. This is from Fox 13. It says, Ferguson and Reichert's plans. On the campaign trail, Ferguson has made Washington's ferry system a key issue. His website outlines plans to elevate the role of WSF leadership to a cabinet-level position, with the head of ferries reporting directly to the governor rather than the Washington State Department of Transportation. He also advocates for increasing the number of passenger-only boats and securing federal funds to enhance ferry services in rural communities like the San Juan Islands. So it's like, oh, Bob wants to do all these things, except Dave Reichert put all that stuff out there first, and then Bob just took it. And they did mention Reichert, meanwhile, has accused Ferguson of copying his ideas, asserting that Democratic leadership is to blame for the current state of the ferry system. He has proposed rehiring workers who were let go during the pandemic for failing to comply with COVID-19 mandates. So it's sort of like, hey, let's just like, Bob wants to do all this stuff, and then here's Reichert over here just saying he stole it from him. So I don't think that that's very fair. But look, the ferry system is a disaster. I laugh about it, but I know that it's critical to people, you know, whether you're going to a wedding, whether you're going to a doctor's appointment, going to see a loved one, or just trying to enjoy a hard-earned vacation or weekend out on our beautiful islands. It's completely unreliable in so many ways, from the crews to the boats to the infrastructure surrounding them. That is a failure. And frankly, it is a failure of leadership. We've had the same leadership in the governor's office for the last 12 years. And so there's really only one place where you can center the blame for that and the lack of planning and all of that. So hopefully people wake up to that and they decide to move this state in a direction where the ferry system is going to be better operated, better maintained, and better managed. That segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. All right, we'll get to our segment Unbelievable coming up next. It's going to take us down to California. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, check out a few real estate agents, but do not choose one until you talk to our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. He and his team have an innovative marketing strategy to make sure the most possible eyeballs are on your listing, but they also have something called the Listing Boost Concierge Service. In the case of undivided viewer Sharona and her husband, they had to do some upgrades to their home, some cosmetic upgrades before they listed it, and Wes said, look, I'll front you $10,000 to do all the updates that I think need to be done so we can get more money out of the house. You do have to pay it back on the back end. But Sharona said they just had to trust him that $10,000 he put in to those changes was going to be worth it at the end.
It was a little scary, but he sent us weekly, I think, reports on how home sales were going in our area. So we knew we were on the right track. And so, you know, my husband and I are not big on debt.
Good.
But, you know, we had to be in debt to get the things done that we needed done. So it was just a lot of praying, like, Lord, just please let this happen. And then trusting that Wes knew exactly what he was talking about and that he would come through in the end, which he did.
Yeah, Wes was able to get their home sold for over list price in just 6 days. So if you're in the market to sell your home, talk to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, lawmakers in California have advanced a bill that would help illegal immigrants obtain home ownership in their state. But there is one big problem with it. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Technically, basically, there's more than one big problem with it. The key problem with AB 1840 is that it rewards people who come here illegally. I mean, that's just the gist of it, right? People come here illegally and you want to gift them taxpayer funds. Basically, they have an existing lottery system in California to help Californians toward home ownership, and it gives them up to $150,000 in loan aid to purchase a home. So that program already exists, but AB 1840 seeks to expand it to illegal immigrants. Basically says that you can't be excluded from the program based on your immigration status. So this advanced in California. AB 1840, except as a local California news station, KCRA, pointed out, there's a big issue with the whole debate.
Lawmakers are trying to expand eligibility for a program that right now has no money. The California Department of Finance confirmed today the state's first-time homebuyers assistance fund has no money to give because California lawmakers and the governor did not put any into it.
So this whole debate becomes like this whole national controversy. We're going to help these illegal immigrants, you know, with loan assistance to buy a home. But the program doesn't even have any funding to be able to do it. And it's not that they haven't gotten to the funding yet and that they just have to. They haven't got there. They haven't done it yet. It's that they actually don't have the money as a state to fund it.
That's because it was part of this year's budget cuts as the state faced a budget shortfall in the tens of billions of dollars. But that did not stop lawmakers today in the state Senate from advancing the bill.
Yeah. So great government there. I saw Bill Malusian with Fox News, who used to be a reporter in Los Angeles, tweet out like, yeah, it sounds about right for California. So they create this big controversy over a bill that's already ridiculous because you're rewarding people who come to this country illegally and say, we have to do this. We have to help them. Let's make a big show of it. Get all these headlines like we're so woke and we're so helpful. But they not only don't even have, they don't have the funding for it. The state of California has a deficit, so they've been dealing with budget cuts, which is even crazier when you think about it, that one of their priorities is trying to push a program that would be very costly when California is struggling so much because of their overspending that they've had to initiate budget cuts. So why are you even talking about bills that would require new funding, additional funding, when you can't even make do with the funding you already have? It's like big government at its worst. I got to say, there was this one Democratic lawmaker who spoke on the floor in support of expanding this housing program to illegal immigrants, made just about the most mind-boggling statement I've ever heard.
This is a common sense bill that allows individuals, many of whom were essential workers during the COVID crisis, to be able to get in line and hopefully buy their first home.
Wait a second. What'd she say? Get in line? Get in line. You know, we just want them to be able to get in line and hopefully, you know, buy their first home in an orderly, legal fashion. Almost like maybe they should have gotten in line to come into the country and they would already qualify for the home ownership program as it was before this bill. It's almost as if like, man, yeah, getting in line and kind of waiting your turn and being able to do things the right way might just be the best way to do it. And it was a brilliant point made by another. They mislabeled this lawmaker. I had to look because I listened to this clip and I'll play it in a second, but I thought that doesn't sound like a Democrat. But they had her as a Democrat in the news report. And I went and Googled and she's a Republican. They mislabel her in this clip as a Democrat. Here it is.
The U.S. as a whole, 1 million immigrants that come here legally, that are actually, many of them are hoping to get assistance to purchase a home. This particular bill, what we're doing here, actually disenfranchises and disrespects those who have actually gone through the process and are ready to purchase a home or would like to purchase a home.
Yeah, exactly. You have a lot of people who came here the right way. They have paid into the system. I met a woman the other day. It took her 25 years to get her U.S. citizenship. So they did it the right way. They waited in a what? Line, right? To get into the country. And now they want to take advantage of this program that California has to help them buy a home. And they're going to be the line. They're going to have people jumping in line who are in this country illegally, who never waited, who never paid into the system. It's really absurd. But I knew when I heard that, that's not a Democrat. I was like, that is not a Democrat, and I had to just double check. No, that was a Republican who said that.
It's just common sense there.
Yeah. Well, and then the other lady used the phrase common sense. This is a common sense bill. And I thought, Common sense really is in the eye of the beholder, because that is not common sense. All right. Absolutely unbelievable. We'll get to some national news coming up next. Kamala Harris is finally sitting down for her first big network interview, one-on-one, to be asked the hard questions. It's really exciting. I'm really proud of her. We'll talk about it coming up in national. First, are you paying attention yet? Look around the world. Look around at what's happening globally, nationally, and think about how it could impact your retirement portfolio. I mean, I'm sure you do. If you're close to retirement and you see everything happen, you're probably like, oh, I wonder how my retirement portfolio is doing. The question is your financial advisor as concerned with what global and national events might be doing to your retirement portfolio? Well, Zach Abraham, the chief investment officer at Bulwark Capital, also host of the Know Your Risk radio podcast, they track him and his Bulwark analysts. They track current events closely so they can adjust to the market risks every day to help shield your portfolio as much as possible. Risk management is Bulwark's number one focus because you only get one retirement. Learn about Bulwark's risk management strategy in their free Common Sense Investing Guide. Get yours now by going to knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. And I cannot stress that enough. I know all of you work so, so hard for what you have and the retirement that you have planned for. Do not leave it up to some financial advisor who isn't properly managing your risk. Again, knowyourriskradio.com. Okay, there it is. Kamala Harris, she's finally doing it. She's finally going to sit down by herself, one-on-one with a serious journalist, with an unbiased network, and ask some hard questions so the American people can know what she stands for. Just kidding. She's going to do it with CNN, and she's not going to do it alone. She's going to have her buddy Tim Walz there in case she can't answer a question.
AKA her emotional support animal.
Emotional support Minnesotan. 100%. This is from CNN. Harris and Walz to sit with CNN for exclusive first joint interview since campaign began. And they're going to sit down with Dana Bash isn't the worst choice. But, you know, we've seen clips. I think she was, it was Dana Bash with J.D. Vance, right? Who was like, oh, well, you know, almost trying to like accuse the Trump administration of things, like in her line of questioning. It was just very weird. And she's no fan of Trump. And, you know, she was accused when CNN did the debate of, you know, things that she and Jake Tapper had already said about Donald Trump and negative things. And it's like, well, how can you be fair, right? How can you be unbiased? But not a surprise that Kamala Harris would pick CNN. And again, I don't think Dana Bash is the worst choice, but it's the presence of Tim Walz that is very telling. We just played a clip on the show yesterday of Kamala Harris. You know, a reporter caught her and asked her a question. And it was the word soup, woke word dice, insane. So now she has someone who I do think Tim Walz is much better on the issues. Now, I don't agree with his stance. I mean, he's definitely got socialist tendencies. But if you have Kamala Harris who doesn't know how to answer a question, Tim Walz is going to be able to jump in and fill in the pieces and save Kamala Harris from her word soup, word salad. Now, the key for Dana Bash is, I think Dana Bash should start the interview. I actually saw Michael Schellenberger say this, is Dana Bash should start the interview saying why, because I'm assuming it was the administration that wanted Tim Walz there. Like, Kamala Harris, are you willing to answer some questions by yourself before we bring Tim Walz into the interview? I think that would be appropriate for CNN to do that. But also Dana Bash should be, and hopefully she can, be aware of the dynamic. And if she's asking questions of the vice president who wants to be president and Tim Walz is consistently helping Kamala Harris fill in the pieces, I hope Dana Bash has the journalistic integrity to say, you know, Mr. Walz, Governor Walz, you know, I'd like the vice president to answer these questions. So we'll see how the interview is conductive. But Nicole, did you make that up? Emotional support?
Oh, no, I saw Governor something about that. 100%. Like, that is perfect. That is what it is. She needed somebody sitting right next to her.
Oh, yeah.
Making her feel like, better.
Oh, let me. 100%. But it was also similar how at the DNC when Joe Biden spoke, they had those signs that everybody had. And then whenever he seemed to be having kind of a lapse, they'd be like, we love Joe. And they get the chance in and give him time to collect his thoughts. Mm-hmm. So she's going to have time to collect her thoughts, and she's going to have Tim Walz there to hold her hand and
Because, you know, she'll just look over, like, give me a little time here to think
about
this.
He'll know, and he'll hop right in. Mm-hmm. So it's up to Dana Bash, and I'm not fully willing to write off Dana Bash because I think sometimes she's okay. she has to know that people are being critical of the choice to have them together. And so hopefully she realizes that she needs to call Kamala Harris out if she's letting Tim Walz pick up the pieces of her answers or jump on the hard questions. Because Kamala Harris is terrible on policy and she hasn't had a policy platform. So I'm looking forward to it. When are they doing that?
That's I think Thursday night.
Tomorrow night. It's gonna be fun. Okay. All right. I'm in. I'm ready.
Always on a Thursday, so we can't talk about it for three more days.
That's all right. I'll stew on it.
Okay.
I also think, isn't the first debate on a... No, that's on a Tuesday, which is good because, wait, we don't have a show that Wednesday, Thursday, so we'll have to do something live. I have a little mini vacation coming up. It's just the tiniest of mini vacations. Mike and I do it every year. Sorry. Mike and I do it every year, and we just have to do it. We have to do it, and I'm so sorry. But we'll talk about that next week. Okay, one more national story I want to get to really quickly, just because it is something I think so relevant to us and some of the challenges that we've been having with Facebook as a platform. So Mark Zuckerberg, I feel like he's slowly being kind of red-pilled or sees the writing on the wall that Americans are being red-pilled, so he wants to be on the right side of history. But he's essentially saying that he wishes that Meta had done more to push back against government efforts to suppress speech on his platform. So he sent a letter to Congress dated August 26. He said, in 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams when we didn't agree. Ultimately, it was our decision whether or not to take content down, and we own our decisions, including COVID-19 related changes we made to our enforcement in the wake of this pressure. I believe the government pressure was wrong, and I regret that we were not more outspoken about it. I also think we made some choices that, with the benefit of hindsight, new information we wouldn't make today. Like I said to our teams at the time, I feel strongly that we should not compromise our content standards due to pressure from any administration in either direction, and we're ready to push back if something like this happens again. Well, that's very convenient. Of course, it doesn't make up for all the damage that was done during the pandemic and suppressing stories that now, which he admits, with the benefit of hindsight and new information, we know weren't misinformation, like a lot of stuff that was said about vaccines and lab leak theories. But I'll say Facebook is still suppressing a lot of content, political speech, newsworthy content. Facebook, just to give you an idea, and we talked about this previously on the show, we have our largest platform by number of followers is Facebook. We have 185,000 followers on Facebook. That number, it was going up steady, steady, steady over a 10-year period of time, and then it completely leveled off around, I would say, 2021 when I left mainstream news. And I've maybe added 1,000 new followers in the last 3 years. And one of the other things I'll say that I said on the show, I tried to contact Facebook about, in one month, we went from an average of about 3 million impressions to 300,000, just like that. And it went, so it was consistent, about 3 million, had slowly built up, earned impressions over time, dropped to about 300,000 a month. And that is roughly where it has remained. And so we know for a fact, and I think it's because we lean conservative, that we are being suppressed on Facebook. I mean, we added, just as an example, 100,000 on Twitter. I think I have about 100,000 followers on Twitter, something like that. We added X as a live streaming platform. Our very first live stream on X maybe had, I think it got up to like 3,000 that day when we first live streamed the show on X. And as a comparison, again, 100,000 compared to 185,000, there are some days where we're lucky to hit 100 on our Facebook stream. And on YouTube, we have even fewer, but YouTube, we have probably 3-4 times the number of people who see our content. And so it's weird that it's just the Facebook part of it. And even, you know, Facebook, because they're tied to Instagram, our growth on Instagram has also completely come to a halt. So we know that there is still a lot of suppression happening with Facebook. And on the contrary, X, I have seen rapid growth on X. Now, part of me had thought it was because Facebook started to follow suit in paying you part of, this gets a little complicated, but I think it's kind of interesting if you don't deal in it. So Facebook started to offer payments for views and impressions and clicks and shares and all of that. So because they're going to put ads on your stuff, et cetera. And so it was like around the time Facebook started doing that, that we saw this huge drop. So my thought was, well, maybe they're trying to like save themselves money and they're like suppressing. They're saying, hey, we're going to help monetize your content, but then they suppress it so they don't have to pay you as much. But I thought, gosh, that kind of doesn't make sense. And then we look at X. X allows us to monetize our content. People can subscribe to our content on X. And for the first time ever, the last 3 months, we're earning money for our engagement on X. And at the same time, our engagement on X is skyrocketing. So if there is some suppression to save money, X doesn't care about saving money. They want your content to grow. So it's just very strange. So I'm glad to hear Mark Zuckerberg say this, but I can tell you definitively, there is still a lot of suppression happening on Facebook. And until I see changes on our page, I have to believe that that suppression is still in play. And that's why we diversify. That's why every day the show streams across Facebook, Patreon, Locals, X, and YouTube. Five platforms. Then if we get banned from one, we've still got the others. If we get suppressed on one, we've still got the others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, we'll get to questions and comments coming up next. First, I have encouraged you, if you have an RV and you're thinking, well, or you want an RV and you're thinking, yeah, where do I put it? Do I want kind of a home base? You've got to check out Natchez RV Resort. It is absolutely awesome out there. I mean, they've got, you know, these extra large lots and it's cool because everybody kind of does their own thing with them and makes them their own, but they've also got so many other things to do there. They've got pickleball courts. They've got a dog park. They just finished their 4,300 square foot clubhouse where you can hang out, invite friends and family, got indoor outdoor fireplace. They're working on finishing their pool and their hot tub. They've got a gourmet kitchen, a gym. I mean, all sorts of stuff. So it really is just a high quality place if you want, you know, to have a home base for your RV. And they have a program where if you're not using your space, they can help rent it out to make you a little bit of your money back. So Natchez RV Resort, they've got extra large RV lots available now starting at just $79.9. You can check them out, NatchezRVResort.com. Again, that is NatchezRVResort.com. Okay, let's get to our daily subscriber show poll. It goes back to our lead story of the day about transgender inmates, because I'll be honest, it's one of those things where I have strong opinions about it, but I don't know if I have a solution. Because look, I do think that there are adults who, you know, believe they're transgender and have, you know, taken steps to get surgery, etc., and for all intents and purposes are living their life as the opposite gender, who might end up in the prison system. Now, I think that there probably could still be, if it's a biological man who's identifying as a woman, I don't think it's appropriate to house them with women, but they might also be in greater danger if they're housed with men. So I'm kind of like, well, what do you do in that situation? Well, don't commit crimes. I agree with that. But then that same sentiment could be used to the women. Well, if you don't want a man to live with you, don't commit crimes. That's not really fair, you know?
Well, no, that's not
the same. But you know what I mean. But if you're saying either you care about the safety of inmates and we have to, or you don't.
But couldn't you say, okay, if you are identifying, when you commit your crime, if you're identifying as a different gender and you've taken steps to not be able to impregnate a woman anymore, then maybe you can live in the female prison because you cannot impregnate a woman and you have been living like that on the outside. But you can't get into a male prison and say, I'm going to, you know, not be able to have sex anymore for the rest of my life. So I think I identify as a woman.
It does seem like they need that to. Needs to be there has to be some judgment to it. And also, if you got the twig and berries, you cannot be in a cell with a woman.
No.
But also, I'm sorry, you were born a man. You have the strength of a man. And like this individual, I don't know this she's male awesome. Inmate. I don't know the status of organs.
Right? As far as I know, he doesn't even have a female name. That is the
right. But
truth.
But
that
he
was
had
recorded.
A strap-on dildo, which we know they give sometimes if you're trying to like.
This report made it seem like he has just recently decided this.
But. Okay, gotcha. So I'm not, I'm saying I'm not 100%
sure
what's happening. We're not 100%
sure, correct.
But I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, where should transgender inmates be housed? In your opinion, should they be housed in the prison that corresponds with their birth gender, in the prison that corresponds with their gender identity, or in a prison specifically for transgender inmates? Because that, I think that's kind of where I land, is it doesn't have to be a separate prison, but like maybe a wing, right? or something like that. You guys are pretty evenly split between in the prison that aligns with their birth gender and in a separate facility for trans inmates. MB voted, I voted in a separate facility, but really just make the thought of prison a deterrent, not let them think which kind of prison they would like. Gerald Taylor, the whole trans concept is completely out of sync with reality and human history. Let's quit being fools about this. That does not relieve the state from their responsibility to secure the safety of inmates. If you are trans, then it is probably a good idea not to be a trans criminal. That's kind of what Nicole said there. Barbara Morrison, if the trans inmates could be safe from harm, I would say put them in a facility that matches their sex at birth. I am not optimistic that safety could be achieved, so I think a separate facility makes sense. How many inmates meet the criteria? And that's the thing, they won't tell us that either. So that's information, right, that we cannot get from the state in terms of like, and they're, look, I get it that they're saying this is a protected health information thing, but I feel like without giving away names, we should be able to get a number on how many transgender inmates there are still
in the prison facility. If you're so proud to be a different gender, then what's the big deal?
Good question, Nicole.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I struggle with this because I just don't see how this makes any sense and who could be fighting for it. I don't understand it.
It really doesn't make any sense. Matthew Cook says, I voted separate facilities. If I care about female inmates being assaulted by trans inmates, I think I should also care about trans inmates being assaulted by male inmates. Yeah, I think that's fair. Jay Qua. While separate facilities logically makes the most sense, I choose birth gender as I would bet most claim trans identity as a way of, as a way out of where they should be or further motives. How many women are claiming to be men? I would guess very few. That's what I'd like to know too. How many transgender women, how many trans men? So women who say they're men are in the men's facility.
Women who were born a man is what you're saying.
No.
Yeah.
Female
facility.
No. Women who were born women who say they're men are in the men's facility.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Got it.
Anyway, so yeah, it's an interesting dilemma that we're in, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right, other comments and questions. Shyamalan, ding dong. My dad passed away yesterday in a similar way as yours. He loved you and I'm watching his mem. I'm so sorry to hear that. Oh, wow. That's tough. Yeah, my father passed away. He was a longtime addict and just couldn't live through it. So I'm really, really sorry to hear that. On the inmates, Hannah Ordo says, you compete, you fight, you sacrifice to be seen as a credible equal. And then here we are again, in terms of like women, protecting women, I assume that means. Why? I only hear of men claiming to be transgender to invade women's spaces. I haven't really heard of women claiming to be transgender insisting on invading male spaces. I wonder why. On the New Yorker article, Slow Nomo says root cause is an underused phrase. Is that about the New Yorker article?
Yeah, so he's saying another phrase is that
that's
he
underused.
It's underused root instead
cause.
Of overused.
Oh, gotcha.
Root cause. So he was talking about jails, I believe. Oh, like why yeah. youth are in jail. So he's putting
the
two
root
stories
cause of
together.
The disproportionate outcomes.
Right.
On the youth jail, Nadine Montreal says it's not, I don't know. It's not disproportionate who are doing the crime, but it's disproportionate to the sentencing. So I think Nadine is saying that black and brown youth are disproportionately sentenced to higher sentences, which I don't have the data to say you're correct or not correct. I'm sure it's out there. Mm-hmm. Jason M., y'all got sweaters on. Is summer over up there?
It feels like it.
We had to turn the heat on today.
I know.
We had to turn the heat on when we came in today. So I hope it's not over yet because we still got stuff to do outside. But
it's supposed to be like 80 on Friday maybe. But okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
This is what happens. It comes and goes. I prefer dressing for fall, frankly.
The clothes, yes. Much but I hate being cold. I really hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think those are the comments for today. Let's get to our closing sanity check. All right, so Kamala Harris supporters were asked about why they're supporting her, you know, what she's accomplished. This is a clip from Alpha News. It's a media outlet in Minnesota that says it focuses on politics and social issues that you may not see in traditional media. So let's see what they heard from Kamala Harris supporters.
What is Harris's biggest accomplishment to date as vice president?
I don't know. I don't feel comfortable doing this anymore.
She's...
She's she was a very good vice president.
That's an interesting question. Getting to vice president.
I have to do more research on her, honestly. I'm just glad to see a woman of color in charge for once. That's it.
I haven't followed her political career that closely.
This is a good one. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't want to go.
America is doomed. Doomed, I say. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. If you have not signed up to support the show already, please do so, especially in this critical election year. We can use the support. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. It's just $5 a month. Also, if you are a skinny, small person, we have, well, not even, you know, our mediums are good sizes.
Average.
If you, well, I know, I'm don't even like that. People.
Yeah, I know. If you wear a
small
medium.
Look, skinny bitches. If you have a, wear a skinnier medium, a smaller medium, we've got shirts left.
Men
and
too, though.
$15 right now.
They're unisex.
They're unisex. Yeah. Well, look, yeah. And our medium's pretty generous. Gosh, I really, look, if you wear a smaller medium, we've got shirts left. The rest of the sizes are sold out, but you can get it for just $15 at our merch store, UndividedPod.com. We're going to be accused of body shaming, whatever it is, UndividedPod.com. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.